Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage, or I should say from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. It's been a while since we've discussed coronary heart disease and atherosclerosis, and so to bring us up to date and remind us about the causes and prevention of this problem, we've invited Dr. Stanley Watkins of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute to be our guest. During the program, we'll also touch on some of the changes going on at the Institute. They're allowing even more services to become available locally for patients in Alaska. If you have questions or comments, you can reach us during the next 40 or 55 minutes or so at our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Watkins did his training at the University of Maryland, his medical degree, and then went on to do internal medicine residency in Dallas at the Southwestern Medical Center, one of our really best training programs, I think, in the country. And then he did a cardiac fellowship there, and then went back to Maryland at Johns Hopkins for an interventional cardiology fellowship. And we'll learn a little bit about interventional cardiology as we go into the program. Dr. Watkins, it's a real pleasure to have you join us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just jump right in. What is, when we say the term coronary heart disease and atherosclerosis, bring us up to date on how do you think about those problems?
Sure. So start from the basics. Your heart is a muscular pump, obviously, that pumps blood throughout the body. And since the heart is always beating and always needs a lot of oxygen and nutrients, the coronary arteries are what bring the oxygen and nutrients to the heart. Mm-hmm. And when people are born, the arteries within the all the arteries within the body are totally normal and don't have any atherosclerotic plaque in them. But as you age, everyone gets some degree of plaque in their arteries, some people at an earlier age than others. And this plaque tends to build up in certain vascular beds, one of which is the heart arteries. As that plaque progresses in the heart arteries, it can create areas of decreased blood supply to the heart, and that can cause patients certain symptoms. The real problem with coronary heart disease is sudden or abrupt closure of a coronary artery, which can result in a heart attack or sudden death.
So when that happens, let's just jump ahead. So you got one of these arteries that are supplying the heart. When it blocks up, then everything downstream is not getting the blood supply or oxygen, and the heart attack is injury or death.
Damage to the heart muscle from a lack of blood supply
in that area. And then depending on how significant and unfortunately sometimes very specific these injuries are, it could injure life.
Definitely. So about a third of people that have heart attacks don't make it to the hospital and die suddenly, and that's because the heart's an electrical organ as well, and if areas of the heart that are electrically active become damaged, you can have electrical problems in the heart that cause the heart to stop beating and result in the condition called ventricular fibrillation or ventricular tachycardia. And that's what we think of as sudden death or out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
So the normal intrinsic beating mechanism can suddenly just go out of whack and to a very, very rapid degree where the heart is the pump action is just insufficient, or it may just stop.
Yep.
And so that's what you don't want to have happen.
That's
about
why
this disease.
That's why the since 30% of people don't make it to the hospital, the only way to prevent those 30% from dying is to prevent the heart attack in the first place, and that's why there's such a an effort to promote prevention of coronary heart disease.
Let me ask you this question. Can you paint a picture of, in your mind's eye, what's going on in these arteries when we talk about arteriosclerosis, atherosclerosis?
Yes. It's a lot easier to do it with a slide up to point out, to take a pointer and point at a slide. But so arteries are made up of three layers. There's a inner layer, and a middle layer, and an outer layer. And over time, cholesterol and various other inflammatory proteins deposit inside the layers of the artery. and it happens in everyone. Like I was saying, it's ubiquitous. But in certain people with certain risk factors, which I'm sure we'll go through, it's more frequent. And this occurs from a young age, studies have shown starting at age 10 to 15, you can already develop atherosclerotic plaques. And over time, these plaques gradually fill up the this middle layer of the artery and can promote a blockage in the artery. And the gradual blockage of an artery is not so much of a problem. It can create symptoms and people can not feel well. But when the artery suddenly blocks off from the plaque becoming unstable, okay, and so instability of the plaque is a huge area of research internationally, and it's from when the plaque deposits in the middle layer of the artery. That's what's called the media of the artery. And there's a layer between the media and the blood flow called the intima. And if there's a thick, rigid area of fibrotic material between the intima and the media, that tends to be what we call a stable plaque. Mm-hmm. If the intima is thin and there's a loose, light lipid core very close to the intima, that plaque can rupture, and the intima then exposes the lipid plaque to the bloodstream. And the exposure of the lipid plaque directly to the bloodstream causes adherence of clotting mechanisms and platelets from the bloodstream that then create a blood clot. It's just like cutting your hand or injuring your leg, and you start to bleed a little bit, and then a blood clot forms. This is what happens on the inside of the artery when a plaque ruptures and a blood clot forms. And then that artery that had normal flow and a minimal blockage of, say, 20% blockage of plaque in the artery goes from normal flow to zero flow because a plaque suddenly forms and a blood clot suddenly forms on the plaque. And that's what, you know, causes fatal events with heart disease. Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, it's, you know, this is the leading cause of death in the United States. And is largely preventable by changing the way we do things. A lot big lifestyle changes can have huge impacts on the risk of heart disease. Mm-hmm. But the mechanism of atherosclerosis, getting back to what you mentioned, is extremely complicated. It's not just elevated cholesterol. It's not just smoking. It's also multiple inflammatory mediators that have been measured and proven to be risk factors for coronary heart disease. And it's both a genetic and an environmental disease. So if you have coronary artery disease running in your family, you carry a higher genetic risk of having a heart attack. Or if you participate in unhealthy lifestyle choices, it carries a risk. But there have been millions and millions and probably billions of dollars spent on looking at specific genes that carry a risk for coronary heart disease, and relatively few have been identified that carry a significant weight in the development of the disease. It's very multifactorial and difficult to put your finger on.
Aha. All right. So this, I've got a picture in my mind, and I want to come back to it, but I want to talk about this pathogenesis a little bit. Or pathogenesis, that's medical terms for why this happens. What are the factors that lead to it? So pardon me for slipping into that word. But how am I going to get to this? So we have a tendency to think that this is and you've mentioned it, it's a lifestyle disease, but we're pretty sure this problem has existed maybe for as long as there have been humans on the earth. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
So it's not all lifestyle.
No.
But lifestyle can modify the severity and therefore the risk of these plaques breaking, is that fair to say, or
definitely
Rupturing?
So, sure, and so, the development of the plaques themselves to begin with. So,
okay.
Yeah, two right. Separate deals. So having an unstable plaque is a relatively different set of risk factors than having the presence of atherosclerosis. Yeah.
So it gets to the point also is you can do everything right. You can be a marathon runner in excellent shape, eating great, doing everything right. You're still going to have some atherosclerosis.
Absolutely.
And if you have the bad day, it ruptures through that enema, and suddenly there's a lot of clots going on that block that artery suddenly, and now you got big problems.
Yep. And then it's a time-sensitive matter to get that artery open and hopefully get it open before the heart stops electrically.
And that's the idea, the reason for the idea of giving aspirin?
Yep.
To someone you think is having a heart attack.
So aspirin in people with acute heart attacks carries a 30% reduction in mortality. So it's a big, big benefit for a simple, easy intervention. And it's because aspirin affects the blood platelets. Blood platelets are the first things that attach onto the lipid core in a plaque rupture and promote the development of that clot. Mm-hmm. So all of our patients are on aspirin. And there's relatively good literature for taking aspirin to prevent heart attacks.
Right.
It's not as firm as the data is for what we call secondary prevention, which is preventing the second event. Once somebody's been identified with, you know, having a higher risk for having heart attacks, put them on aspirin. They do great with aspirin. People trying to figure out who the right person is out of the general population to take aspirin to prevent a heart attack is a little bit more tricky.
All right, let me remind listeners again, my guest today is Dr. Stanley Watkins of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, and we're trying to understand this business about coronary artery disease, coronary heart disease, one of the major causes of death in most developed countries in the world, certainly after a certain age. That's the fact. That's true. And if you've got questions or comments, you can reach us locally at 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and you can email at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, again, just to make sure I'm understanding this, we're all at risk of developing atherosclerosis no matter what we do. It's a natural part of life, but certain environmental factors, that's currently in vogue in medicine, but environmental factors increase the risk of worsening atherosclerosis and therefore also increase the risk of these ruptures, which is really what does us in, at least in the heart. And other arteries throughout the rest of the body can also have these, the carotid arteries going to our brain and arteries in our legs and so forth. But it's the heart disease that really ends up causing death in the long run most of the time.
Yes.
Okay. So what are the other risk factors that we need to control or helped control this process?
Right. So we always advocate blood pressure control. We advocate physical activity. So maintaining healthy aerobic exercise on a regular basis. Staying thin. So this is one thing that I spend a lot of time talking with my patients about. The fat in the abdomen is a endocrine organ. It synthesizes hormones that promote atherosclerosis and plaque deposits. And so staying thin and having a thin abdomen is important. And so so high blood pressure, staying thin, being physically active, a huge one is quitting smoking. So Alaska has a fairly high smoking rate, 25% or 27%, depending on what you believe. Almost all of my patients with peripheral vascular disease or plaque buildup in the legs or peripheral arteries outside the heart are all smokers. Mm-hmm. And so we spend an enormous amount of time and effort trying to get people to quit smoking. It's incredibly difficult. It's a wicked addiction. So smoking cessation is extremely important to us. And then you have your non-modifiable risk factors, are the ones that you can't do anything about. You know, your gender, whether you're male or female. Men tend to be affected earlier by coronary heart disease, but women tend to get it just as much and more severe presentations at a later age. And then who your parents were, your genetic makeup. If everyone in your family has had coronary heart disease, you're going to be at a significantly higher risk, regardless of what your cholesterol is or what your blood pressure is. I didn't mention cholesterol, but obviously we screen, you know, the recommendations are to be screened for hypercholesterolemia or elevated cholesterol once a year. The the best pharmaceutical impact we can make on people's risk going down the road is lowering blood cholesterol with cholesterol-lowering drugs.
Mm-hmm. What's the epidemiology? And by that, I mean, what do we know about what's happened over the last 50 years to the how often people are developing significant atherosclerosis? And then also there's the question is, what about outcome? I mean, we're living longer, so something's changing.
Yeah, so it's this is changing? A good story. This is one of the good stories in medicine. So the population risk for coronary heart disease peaked in 1968 in the United States. And since 1968, every year there's been a decline in the age-adjusted risk of dying from heart disease.
Despite the fact that we're getting heavier.
Okay. Despite the fact that we're drinking more high fructose corn
right.
syrup and
right.
eating more trans fats, we're
right.
still living longer and having less coronary heart disease. And part of it, so there's a bunch of studies that have looked at what the cause in the decreased mortality
right.
rate from heart disease. Is it earlier detection and earlier treatment? Is it better treatment, or is it preventing the disease from the start? And it's a little bit of each. Mm-hmm. So the risk of dying from a heart attack when in 1960s and 1970s, the treatment for a heart attack was we basically put people in the hospital and watch them and hope that they survive. We really didn't have any proven medical treatments for patients with heart attacks. Now we've realized that time is of the essence. That artery gets opened as soon as possible. And if somebody shows up within 2 hours of the onset of a heart attack, you can save their heart completely with minimal scar. And their prognosis is excellent. So it used to be you presented to the hospital with a heart attack. 30% of people didn't make it out of the hospital with their first heart attack. Now 96% of people make it out of the hospital with their first heart attack.
Wow.
So there's a 4% in hospital mortality for heart attacks now. It used to be high 20s, and that's been a change over the past 40 years, and it's largely due to what we call reperfusion or restoring blood flow to the heart acutely. But that's a real small part of the overall improvement in mortality. Some of it's been identification of risk factors. So in the 50s, we didn't even know what the risk factors were for heart disease. We had presumptions. We knew that it ran in families, and we knew that smokers were at higher likelihood for coronary heart disease. But the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute started the Framingham Heart Study, and they followed a whole town of people and looked at the people down the road 10, 15, 20, 30, now almost 50 years out to see which patients developed or which subjects in that town developed coronary heart disease. And from that, they were able to pick apart what risk factors played the biggest effect on the development of heart disease. And that's where we've come out with are the standard risk factors that we follow: high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, physical inactivity, and obesity. And so from that, we've then started screening the general population for these risk factors. If someone walks into their primary care physician's office and they're overweight and they have high blood pressure and they have high cholesterol and they're pre-diabetic, they now get medical interventions at each one of those risk factors, whereas in the 1950s, they did not. So it's been a multi-pronged approach, but it's each year the mortality from coronary heart disease goes down. That doesn't mean that the total number of people that are showing up with heart disease is decreasing. It's because people are living longer and presenting later with mm-hmm. heart disease. And instead of having one heart attack and dying, they're having one heart attack and then living for 10 or 15 years until they have a second one. Or most of them, don't even have a second heart attack anymore. Right. And so it's a good story to tell. I can tell
right.
the number of heart attacks that have been prevented over the past 50 years is inordinate. Something like a million a year have been prevented if the current rate in 1968 had been sustained.
Mm-hmm. So in any time there's a very complex disorder with multiple risk factors, it gets really difficult to tease this out, which is what I hope the listeners heard from what you said. Part of it's intervention, part of it's dietary changes, part of it's there's lots of reasons. And smoking comes to my mind. That's a big change from the 60s, or even though there's still a lot of people smoking. How would you rate, from your understanding, the decrease in smoking as one of the contributing factors? Is it one of the big ones? We can't tell for sure where we are.
I think
right
it's
now.
One of the big ones. And yeah. So you can look at smoking rates across populations across right. the United States. Right. And there's a tight correlation between the risk of smoking and the number of heart attacks and longevity.
To help people understand this disorder some more, let's go back to this thing we talked about just before we came on the air. There was a study not too long ago where they looked at mummies. Some of the mummies were 4,000 years old in Egypt. There's some mummies in Peru. There's some mummies in southwest part of the United States and some on the Aleutian Islands. So some were 4,000 years old. Some are still within the common era after, you know, we went from BC to AD. But it turns out that there was a significant amount of atherosclerosis in all of these, in a high percentage of these mummies. Well, how should we interpret that information based on what we've been talking about?
Yeah, so this has turned a lot of the people who promote specific diets to prevent heart disease. Yeah,
so they were
on their
pretty
heads.
Organic.
Well, you would think. So the first trial to come out. So just to orient folks, the way they tested for atherosclerosis in a mummy. I mean, you see, everyone's seen right. what a mummy looks like, and you sort of think, how would you test whether or not a mummy has plaque in their arteries? Well. If plaque has been in the arteries for more than 5 to 10 years, it becomes chronic plaque, and the body starts to deposit calcium in the plaque. The calcium deposits are evidence of old plaque that's been there for a while, and calcium is fairly stable. And in these mummies, they took the mummies and put them on a CT scan, and were able to, so calcium shows up very bright on a CT scan, and their hearts are still intact, and you can see calcium deposits on the outside of their arteries. It looks amazingly similar to the calcium tests that we do in the office mm-hmm. all the time to screen folks. And so the first study came out with the mummies, and they said, oh, look, 30% of these mummies have plaque in their arteries and plaque in their aortas. And they said, we didn't think that people had coronary heart disease back that far ago. And then the dietary skeptics came back and said, these are the rich, these are the upper level of society in Egypt, and they were eating, a high fat diet and weren't doing any physical activity. They weren't the ones hauling the rocks up the pyramids. They right. were, pointing out where to put them.
Right.
And so. They suffered from a similar thing or similar concept to what we think of as modern day physical inactivity and poor diet. So then a second trial came out to try and build on this. They looked at actually some natives from the Aleutian Islands that had been frozen in tundra and very well preserved. For I think it's 400 or 500 years. They weren't 4,000 year old, but they were 400, 500 years. And the average age in them were 20 to 30 years old. And they did the same CAT scans on them, and they showed a 30% rate of significant plaque deposits in the arteries. And it was tough to make the dietary comment on the Aleutians because they're eating really only whole grains. And fish, and game meat, mm-hmm. and so hard to say that they're eating a bad diet. And mm-hmm. and as far as physical activity goes, you can imagine they're doing about as much as you can possibly do. Mm-hmm. So it has really changed the way some of us look at the development of atherosclerosis. We spend a lot of time. And billions of dollars of research looking for new risk factors for heart disease, mm-hmm. always looking for the one smoking gun that predicts heart disease. And in my opinion, it's probably not out there. Hopefully I'm proven wrong. But each time we parse out the genetic data and all the proteins and other things we look at in subjects to see what's going to predict a heart attack in a patient. We come back to the same old five risk factors that came out from the original Framingham study. Mm-hmm. And, you know, spending gazillions of dollars on trying to limit trans fats and trying to limit sodas may not be that important. If you can look back and see that Aleutian Indians were, you know, had a 30% rate of coronary plaque, you know, 1,000 years ago.
So I guess another way for us to think about this is disease of humans. It's a natural consequence of humans,
and
to
it's
some
a,
degree.
It occurs
I mean,
with
most
aging.
Of, we're going to mm-hmm. have it gets it happens with aging.
Yep.
And however, it doesn't mean we shouldn't be careful about environmental impacts, because there's very good evidence that being overweight, developing diabetes, having hypertension, and smoking increases the risk of problems. It's not that that may be the cause, just like asthma is triggered by multiple different things. And when you think about the cause, I think about genetics. I don't think
right.
about, but I think about smoke is a risk factor for making it worse, and allergies are a risk factor for making it worse. And that's, in a sense, the same idea.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you look at, you know, if everybody looks at themselves and decides what's the most likely thing to make them die, it is in everybody, in almost everybody, it's coronary heart disease. And mm-hmm. so we have pretty well established guidelines for what you can do to decrease your personal risk from heart disease. And what I try to do with my patients, especially in prevention, is to focus on the simple things. Because if you look up coronary heart disease prevention on the internet, you just get lost in all this minutia, and you know, people come and ask and say, "Gosh, you know, I heard red wine is okay,
right.
But it
right.
gives me the hives. You know, can right. I try white wine? And yeah. you know, I've changed my diet to be totally vegan, right. Right. and I'm miserable, and I really wish I could just have one steak, but you know, I know I'm going to have a heart attack if I do." And I say, "You know, look, it's not yeah. that simple, and
absolutely.
you know,
yeah.
it's a balance between you know, living a quality life and yeah. Doing what's smart."
All right. So before we go to break, exercise, try not to overeat.
Yep. Don't smoke.
Don't smoke.
Get your blood pressure checked.
Get your
and get your cholesterol checked.
Yeah. All right. Those are factors that clearly decrease your likelihood of having coronary artery disease.
Yep.
All right. Let's take a short break. That's what we usually do about this time. Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. You can also email us during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Stan Watkins of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute on coronary artery disease, or coronary heart disease, I should say. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We're discussing the causes, prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of coronary heart disease with Dr. Stanley Watkins of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. You can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433, or you can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And let me remind everybody, this is a very important program, and if you want to listen to it again, you want to recommend somebody listen to it, you can always just tell them to go to www.alaskapublic.org, and find the Line One link, and you will find all of our previous programs, including this one, which you can listen to at any time, or I believe you can even kind of download it. Certainly you can listen to it also on iTunes. If you go to iTunes, you can find a Line One there as well. So let's move ahead a little bit more into what the Alaska Heart Institute is doing to help us not have to do so much out of the state of Alaska as when I first moved up here. And one of the things I should mention is it appears to me that your name has changed from Alaska Heart Institute to Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. So perhaps you can start by telling us why that change.
Sure. So since the Alaska Heart Institute spends we spend most of our time dealing with coronary atherosclerosis or coronary heart disease, or we had up to several years ago. We've noticed, and it's been sort of a national shift for cardiology and cardiovascular practitioners to start taking care of vascular disease that's outside of the heart. So, like we were talking about earlier before the program, most patients who develop atherosclerosis outside of the coronary vasculature, so atherosclerosis of the legs, what we call peripheral arterial disease, of the kidney arteries or of the carotid arteries, ultimately die from either stroke or heart attacks. And if you have peripheral vascular disease, you're 10 times more likely to have a heart attack than somebody who does not have peripheral vascular disease. So it's the strongest risk factor for coronary heart disease, and we consider it a spectrum. The government considers it a risk equivalent to having a previous heart attack, having documented plaque in your legs or your neck. And since we've taken it upon ourselves to be the ones to prevent cardiovascular disease, we feel like we're best suited to take care of patients medically with peripheral arterial disease and carotid vascular disease. We have a prevention clinic at the Heart Institute where patients who have not been diagnosed with vascular disease can be seen and given an assessment of their cardiovascular risk, and then be placed on appropriate therapy for prevention of heart attacks down the road. And because of that, we do a lot. Me being an interventional cardiologist, just to explain what that is, I spend a large part of my time treating patients with acute heart attacks and doing coronary angiograms for patients who have symptomatic heart disease or plaque buildup in the heart arteries that's producing symptoms in patients. And the same thing is true for plaque buildup in the legs or the neck. So we are qualified to take care of the blockages in the legs just as well as we are in the heart. And the main thing is, once they're identified, we get them on a lifestyle and treatment program to decrease the risk of a subsequent heart attack down the road.
Mm-hmm. What other new things do you guys, I don't know what things is not, modalities do you have? And I'm thinking about implants now that are doing all kinds of fancy things. I was listening about Vice President Cheney's worry about somebody stopping his heart with the Wi-Fi the other day. And so there's a lot more going on in treatment and prevention besides in diagnosis, even, it sounds like, that maybe we want to talk about briefly.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a field that's expanded so rapidly that there's no way I could possibly touch on everything that's going on. But some of the major things that have come up recently, we've started to use a implantable heart pump that is able to be put in the cardiac catheterization laboratory at Providence, and can sustain somebody's heart beating. It's a percutaneous or a heart-lung bypass machine that you can put in at the bedside and totally sustain someone who has suffered a massive heart attack to the point that they can be transferred safely and potentially end up with a heart transplant. We have at the Heart Institute advanced imaging for peripheral arterial disease with CAT scans, and we have an excellent cardiac MRI program. We have, the list goes on forever. As far as interventional therapy for coronary artery disease, we haven't talked much about stents, but stents have been a major impact in improving cardiovascular morbidity and mortality. And people come in with a heart attack and they have a blocked artery. The first thing we do is unblock the artery by suctioning out the clot, and then we place a stent in the area where the plaque was to begin with. And this has a huge benefit on recurrent mortality and quality of life as far as decreasing shortness of breath and chest pains associated with heart blockages. Mm. And the stents started out in the mid-90s, and each year they come out with a slicker, easier to deliver, and more effective stent, to the point now that they're incredibly efficacious, and you can treat just about any coronary artery disease with stents, which has led somewhat from a shift from open heart surgery to treating coronary artery disease with stents. Similarly, in the lower extremities, there have been advances in the stents that we can use in the legs, in the thigh, in the abdomen. We can now treat abdominal aortic aneurysms with stent grafts that can be put in through a relatively small hole in the femoral artery instead of having to undergo an enormous abdominal surgery. So there's been it's too many advances to really...
Yeah, so the point I'm hearing is that most things that we, being Alaskans, think we have to maybe go somewhere else to get done can get done here as well.
Absolutely. There are two things that we need in the state, or that we could use. I shouldn't say we definitely need, but we could use. We send patients out for heart transplants, mm-hmm. and for what's becoming, what's replacing heart transplants in a lot of centers is implantable ventricular assist devices. This is what Dick Cheney had. It's not everybody qualifies for a heart transplant. Mm-hmm. These are small pumps that can be put inside the chest and support the perfusion of the body using the existing heart. And the problem with heart transplants is there just are not enough hearts to go around. Mm-hmm. We've seen a decrease in donors because of motorcycle helmet laws. Yep. And so the number of heart transplants is actually going down, but the number of these implantable ventricular assist devices has gone way up. We have actually a program at the Heart Institute with our heart failure specialist, Dr. Amos, where people have been sent out to the lower 48 for the placement of their ventricular assist device, and she has a way to follow the people up here. We have several patients who have implantable ventricular assist devices that she manages. So that's one thing that we could have. Now we have to support them with a smaller pump, send them out, and take care of them when they come back. The other big thing that we don't have that we're looking to get is stent valves. So aortic valve disease, or what we call what's from aortic stenosis, which is a degenerative form of narrowing of the aortic valve, the outflow valve of the heart, affects a huge population of folks over the age of 70 and 80. And up until a few years ago, that was a disease that had to be treated with open heart surgery. Now they're making an aortic valve that's mounted in a stent. There's actually five or six companies that make them. They're FDA approved only for people that are too high risk for open surgery. But there's a lot of centers that are doing a very high volume of these, and patients do incredibly well. And that's something that we really need to bring to the state, because the folks that are too sick for open heart surgery are usually too sick to get on a plane and fly to Seattle and have a procedure. And so that's something that we're actively bringing up, hopefully in the next year.
I'm going to make one comment just in case listeners get a little bit confused about heart failure. Heart failure is when the pumping capacity of the heart is no longer sufficient, and that is not compatible with life. So, and that could be a consequence. One reason is a consequence of severe coronary artery disease, which is, in a sense, knocked off so much muscle that it's no longer functioning. So now you can implant a robotic, and robot's not the right word, but you can put in a new pumping chamber that's been made, and so you no longer need a heart transplant, and that can keep people going. And that's what you said Cheney had, and so it's a consequence of severe, could be a consequence of severe coronary artery.
Yeah, multiple heart attacks,
there
which
are
is, yeah, it's
other
what he
reasons,
had.
But that's.
That's the biggest cause is multiple heart attacks.
All right. We've had Jerry hanging on for a while. I want to get Jerry's phone call because he looks like he's going to ask about cholesterol, and I moved ahead and away from some of the special issues on cholesterol, and I want to get back to that. Jerry, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes. Thank you, doctors. Appreciate the discussion today. It might all be relative, but what is a general number you might be looking for if you are on cholesterol meds to go to 90, 100, total overall?
All right, I'm going to ask Dr. Watkins to kind of talk about the cholesterol, HDL, and all of them, and use this as a segue into that whole discussion. But let's not forget to answer his question about
what the target is.
If you're on the medications, what's the target here?
So total cholesterol is made up of, to simplify it a bit, the good cholesterol and the bad cholesterol. And the good cholesterol is the HDL, or the high density lipoprotein, and the bad cholesterol is the LDL. If you look at plaques in arteries, it's largely made up of LDL cholesterol. HDL is the good cholesterol is what's thought of as the transport mechanism for bringing LDL cholesterol back to the liver for metabolism. The goal for treatment with lipid lowering medications is largely, we don't look so much at the total cholesterol, we look at the LDL cholesterol. And if you have if you're low risk and you have not had a heart attack and you don't have diabetes, the LDL goal is less than 160. If you have two risk factors such as smoking or hypertension, then the goal is less than 130. If you have established coronary artery disease or what's determined to be a coronary risk equivalent, such as peripheral vascular disease or diabetes, then the goal is less than an LDL less than 100. So that's the treatment goal that we mostly strive for.
Thank you, Doctor. That's excellent. Appreciate it.
Yep.
All right. Somebody told me once on this program, HDL stands for highly desirable lipid.
That's correct.
And LDL for less desirable. So you want good HDLs and you don't want much LDLs hanging around.
The bad thing about HDLs is that there's no good treatment for it. So with LDL, all you got to do is take a pill and it cuts your LDL in half. It's easy. HDL, the pharmaceutical industry has been trying for years to make a drug that will raise HDL, and they've succeeded. But each time they bring that drug to a clinical trial and test it on people to see if it prevents heart attacks, it actually raises the risk of heart attack, and more people die on the drug, so they end up thrown in the scrap heap. So the safe and effective way to raise your HDL and decrease your risk of heart attack is to get thin and do regular exercise. Unfortunately, there's no pill for raising HDL.
So here's an email that comes in, either from a researcher or a physician pretending to be. All right. So three questions. Let's just do one at a time here. How much should a person pay attention to small pattern B LDL particles quantity and size?
That's a good question. Yeah, so
I have no idea what they're talking about.
So this is a question about advanced lipid testing. So
right.
The football player mentality of testing for cholesterol is you test your HDL, you test your LDL, and you get your total cholesterol, and that's it. The more cerebral way is to look at the makeup of the HDL and the LDL particles. And the particles can be fractionated, and it turns out that people that have a higher prevalence of small, dense LDL particles have a higher risk of developing or of having clinical endpoints of heart attacks. And there are some people that advocate strongly for advanced lipid testing. From a lumper perspective, if you look at whether or not the patient has diabetes and what the triglyceride level is and the HDL level is, you can pretty much tell what the LDL particle size is going to be. So if the HDL is low and the triglycerides are high, there's a high risk or high likelihood that the LDL particle sizes are going to be small. And so it's pretty rare that you find somebody that has a normal triglycerides, high HDL, and has a lot of small, dense LDL. Mm-hmm. That's almost, it's extremely rare. So spending the additional dollars for that test, and it's, you know, a couple hundred dollars for the test, hasn't been shown in clinical practice and clinical trials to have an impact on what therapy the patient receives. And so there's a lot of people that advocate for it. Of course, the people who make the test advocate for it. But I haven't seen a study that's shown that it impacts long-term outcomes.
All right. So the answer to the question, should you pay attention to it, is it's not ready for prime time
Probably. Yet. Yeah.
But stay tuned. Keep reading. Keep asking.
Yeah.
Okay. Second question. If a person has a high calcium score, say 1,000, how much does one single risk factor play into the overall risk profile?
This is an awesome question. So we didn't talk anything about calcium scoring, right. But just like we talked about mummies having calcium deposits in their heart arteries, if you're someone that doesn't meet the standard criteria for cardiovascular risk, so you don't have high blood pressure, you don't have diabetes, but you do have a strong family history of heart disease, and there are a lot of people like this out there, they don't meet criteria for our most effective prevention mechanism, which is a statin drug or a lipid-lowering drug. If you do a calcium score, a calcium test, which is a CAT scan that takes about 10 minutes to do, doesn't involve any contrast, doesn't involve an IV, they just take a quick CAT scan of the heart and look for calcium deposits in the arteries, and they can grade the amount of calcium that you have in your arteries compared to your age-related peers. So everybody gets some calcium deposits, just like everybody gets some plaque as you get older. What you want to know is your calcium score significantly higher than people your age? And we'll give you a percentile for where you fit. If you're in the 99th percentile, that means you have more calcium deposits than 99% of your peers. If you're in the 10th percentile, then 90% of people have more calcium than you do. And so a calcium score of 1,000, unless you're 80 or 90 years old, is usually going to put you in a higher risk category. And regardless of what your cholesterol numbers are, you probably ought to be on a cholesterol-lowering drug. That's a matter for a, you know, individual discussion with the patient. Mm-hmm. Most people would recommend a cholesterol-lowering drug.
Last question. Let me remind people we're about 8 or 9 minutes before we get to the end. So, and we're suddenly getting some phone calls and some other emails. But the last one from this listener is, sugar seems to be a new trendy risk factor as opposed to cholesterol. Some cardiologists are saying cholesterol is way overemphasized and sugar is the culprit. So this gets to sometimes there are things that show up in the newspaper and every minute where there's arguments about how medications are working, whether cholesterol is the issue. And so sugar or cholesterol, what do we know?
So definitely foods with a high glycemic index, foods that give you a high spike in insulin production, concentrated sweets or simple sugars are probably bad. There's a lot of studies that suggest that they are bad. Having an elevated blood sugar clearly carries a risk of heart attack and stroke, and obviously the development of diabetes. So I think there's only so much you can do for your personal blood sugar aside from staying skinny. So if you have high blood sugar, you need to lose as much weight as you possibly can and be as active as you possibly can. And once you're skinny and active and you still have a high blood sugar, then you have diabetes that has to be managed with pharmaceutical means. Avoiding concentrated sweets is a good idea. I think most of the dietary data suggests foods that have a high glycemic index are poor, and I, you know, try and steer my patients away from them. You know, whole grains, fruits and vegetables. If you're going to eat meats or proteins, try and make them as lean as possible, with the ultimate goal being, you know, staying as thin as possible and keeping that abdominal fat at bay.
We didn't talk at length about how smoking adds to the risk. Here's a question that somewhat gets at this. As we constantly hear about smoking as a contributor to heart disease, what about chewing tobacco? Is the issue caused by the smoke itself or the ingredients in tobacco?
So it's a good question. The chewing tobacco is a little bit harder to study from an epidemiologic perspective because not as many people do it as smoke cigarettes. And there's a lot of people that both smoke and chew tobacco. But the existing literature is way stronger against tobacco smoke than it is chewing tobacco. I wouldn't go as far as to tell my patients to start chewing tobacco and get rid of smoking, but it's not just the nicotine that's in the tobacco, and a lot of it is the tar and the other chemicals that are in the tobacco smoke. So the well-done epidemiologic studies for chewing tobacco have not shown as strong a risk as smoking has. So. Okay.
Yeah,
all the people who treat oral cancers out there are groaning right now.
We don't know about smoking, but don't do it.
It's a terrible idea.
Oral cancers are hugely increased by chewing tobacco. Let's leave it at that. Sylvia, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes. For many years, I've heard that fish oil supplements were an excellent preventative and a help to anyone who had heart disease or varying things. And now all of a sudden you read that fish oil is not the best thing to take for that. And I'm wondering what your viewpoint is on that.
So the smaller studies for fish oil were positive in favor of what we want. So what we want out of an intervention for either dietary or pharmaceutical for heart disease is to prevent heart attacks and to prevent sudden death. Personally, it doesn't matter to me how much whatever it does changes your triglycerides or changes your HDL or changes your LDL. I want to know, does it prevent you from having a heart attack and does it make you live longer? And the fish oil supplements do have a positive impact on triglycerides and HDL, like a lot of other pharmaceuticals have. But in rigorous clinical trials, they have not shown a statistically significant benefit in decreasing the risk of heart attack. Interestingly, they've shown that a benefit in decreasing the risk of sudden death if you do have a heart attack. And so there's a trend towards a overall benefit, but it's not as strong as we would have liked to think, you know, living in Alaska and eating tons of omega-3 fatty acids. It's not as strong an effect as directly lowering the LDL cholesterol.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. What has been shown to definitely, scientifically, validly decrease atherosclerosis?
So there's only two drugs that have been proven to reduce atherosclerotic burden in the heart artery. So there's all different ways to measure atherosclerotic burden. You can do serial calcium scores and see if the calcium deposits decrease. You can look at the neck arteries, carotid plaque and see if the carotid plaque decreases. But what we really want to know is, does plaque in the coronary arteries decrease? And the only way to do that is to test it with a put a catheter inside the heart artery, directly measure the burden of plaque in the artery, and then put those patients on an intervention. And half of them would get a sugar pill and half of them would get whatever treatment you're trying to prove will regress plaque. The two most potent statin drugs have been proven to reduce plaque. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't other treatments out there that may regress plaque or document, plaque regression. It's just most of the other interventions don't have a pharmaceutical sponsor to pay for a clinical trial that will test that hypothesis. So, but we know that atorvastatin, which is Lipitor at 80 milligrams, will on average regress plaque in the coronary arteries, and Crestor at rosuvastatin at 20 milligrams will regress plaque. Those same drugs at lower doses, there is continued progression of plaque deposits.
We are in our last 2 minutes, and I like to leave time for us to make sure the listeners hear again the most important bits of information here. And I want to apologize to a couple of people who we did not get to their emails, but this is more important. What do we want to remember here?
So the main, the main take-home messages are quit smoking, try and do some amount of physical activity at least 3 to 5 times per week. 30 minutes. Physical activity should be aerobic activity, walking briskly, slow jogging. Have your blood pressure checked. Have your cholesterol checked. Those are the main prevention risks.
Okay. And if you're having symptoms of cardiac disease, tightening in your chest with exercise, radiation into your arm, go see somebody.
Yeah, especially if it comes on suddenly, then you should call 911.
Not much time, but who should and shouldn't take, should aspirin be used prophylactically by any age group with exceptions of people who have risks or not?
Good question. Aspirin for primary prevention. The data is pretty good for men over the age of 65. Okay. The big debate is in aspirin for women. And there's a lot of people that would argue against using it for even men. But most of my patients, I advocate it.
Yeah. So you got to look at the risk-benefit individually is what I hear you saying.
Yep.
There's some risk to taking aspirin, even though we're not talking about a lot of aspirin.
Baby aspirin is 81 milligrams is the recommended dose.
Thanks very much. This has been a wonderful show. Yeah. Did a good job.
Thanks.
My thanks to Stanley Watkins of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. And if you want to continue this conversation, just join us on KSKA on Facebook. And you can find that link at www.alaskapublic.org. On the next program, I'm going to be talking with Anchorage gynecologist Dr. Tina Thompson, and we're going to discuss the current recommendations for pap smears and the prevention of cervical cancer. So why not tune in and learn more next Monday, November 11th. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt helped us today with our engineering, and she's also our web editor. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.